This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Since the 2008 campaign of President Barack Obama, there's been somewhat of an obsession about just how black the president is. Many folks on the right have criticized the president for being too black. Many on the left denounce him for acting white. What exactly does that mean? In their latest book, Acting White, Meetu Gulati and Devin Carbato try to find out what goes into the perception and performance of race. Meetu Gulati is a professor of law at Duke Law School, Devin Carbato a professor of law at UCLA's law school, and they are co-authors of the new book, Acting White, Rethinking Race in Post-Racial America. Welcome to the program. Good to talk with both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
So, Meetu, tell us about how this project got started.
I think it was about 15 years ago, Devin and I got our first jobs at UCLA, and I was terrified of driving on the LA freeways. And so I would drive into work at an obscenely early hour. I think I used to drive in at between 5:30 and 6:30 in the morning so I could avoid all possible traffic. And because I got in here so early, I had a lot of time to watch the rich people walk their dogs. And I confess, I started taking notes on which of them picked up their dog poop. Uh-huh. And I found that there were racial differences that I perceived in whether or not people picked up their dog poop. And in particular, the more privileged you are, and in particular, I noticed a few important movie stars who did not pick up their dog poop. And then Devin and I... We were working all the time because we were petrified we wouldn't get tenure and would lose our jobs. So in between being stressed about things like that, we would sit down and just talk about our lives. And so I started talking to him about my dog poop watching activities. And he had the idea that, you know, this was just a much more complicated social phenomenon relating to race, because I was telling him about what I was viewing in terms of racial differences, in particular privileged white men versus other privileged people of other races, because UCLA is located in a very upscale portion of town. And that got us thinking about how does this translate into the workplace. And
well, Devin,
15 years later,
I want to get your take on what happened when Meetu started talking about his dog observations.
First of all, thought, why is he telling me about these particular activities? What relevance could they possibly have? But then it occurred to us that something was going on that made certain whites more comfortable not abiding by community norms, and people of color very concerned about whether or not they were abiding by those very same norms. So it suggested to us that that might be a moment in which people are actually managing their identities. And so we immediately began thinking about what that might mean in other contexts, including but not limited to the workplace. So if there are expectations that you will be a violator of the norm, you're much more to engage in a certain kind of self-governance to ensure that you're not. And so we thought that that might have implication for how people negotiate their identities in everyday life, including, again, but not limited to the workplace.
Well, Devin, I'll stick with you for a minute. That suggests that you have internalized the perception, right, or that you are among those who are likely not to abide by the norm. In other words, you know people are looking at you, expecting you to break the rules, and you've internalized that.
That's exactly right. And you can think about whether that's right or wrong, but the fact that you might know that you will be under that sort of gaze, so to speak, means that you're very vigilant about the way in which you might perform your identity. And sometimes this happens unconsciously. So we don't want to suggest that it's always this conscious effort to navigate how people interpret who you are. But it's just the fact, if you know that you are vulnerable to being stereotyped as a criminal, let's say, that when you walk into that department store, that does something to how you interact with people in that context.
Well, Meetu, maybe I can ask you to talk a little bit about your background and whether or not you've ever experienced that.
Well, I think initially when we started thinking about this, I was thinking largely in terms of African Americans and Latinos. And when Devin and I talked about it, you know, the stereotypes that apply to different racial groups in this country are radically different. But then 9/11 came along, and I look like someone from a part of the world where they engaged in a lot of terrorist activities. And very quickly, I began realizing that I was doing a lot of policing of the way in which I dress. And anybody who knows me will tell you that I am one of the sloppiest dressers on the entire Duke faculty. But see me when I'm going to the airport and I am clean-shaven and dressed very nicely with proper shoes and everything. And I had to travel a lot. So during the period immediately after 9/11, and I began exerting a lot of effort in that way. Now, as you count the ways in which you behave all through the day, the book is mostly about work, but I find myself policing what I do in many ways as a function of what I think people think about me and how to negate negative stereotypes of that sort of thing. But the airport is, for me, the most vivid example of how this operates.
So, Devin, how did you go about studying this phenomenon? It seems so subtle and in many cases so unconscious. How do you go about actually putting together a book on this?
Well, interestingly, our starting place was to think about gender. In many ways, we understand the phenomenon that we write about in the book in the context of gender, in the sense that we get that gender discrimination isn't simply a function of, let's say, a manager at a workplace preferring all men over women so that they're just hiring men. That certainly is a form of sexism that still exists. But we also understand that institutions every day prefer some women over others. So let's say the feminine woman over the masculine woman. And people view that as an instance of sex discrimination, not just as a matter of sort of theory, but as a matter of law. And it occurred to us that a similar dynamic was likely at play with respect to race. That is, institutions were not simply saying, we don't want any black people, right? Those sort of Jim Crow practices are largely dead. But people might be saying, we're going to think about the kind of black person we want. So there was an intra-group decision that was being made that very much aligns with the intra-group decisions that occur in the context of gender. So the gender cases and feminist theorizing on this point was enormously important to our being able to describe the racial performance dynamic we set out in the book.
And this brings us to the case of Renee Rogers and her suit against American Airlines in the 1960s, right?
Precisely. And so there you have an instance in which American Airlines has this policy that basically says no braids. So American Airlines is not saying no black women. It's saying no braids. And so Renee Rogers brings suit saying, look, this is going to have a disparate impact on black women. And the court basically says we do not find actionable discrimination here, in part at CEG Bo Derek, meaning Bo Derek has this hairdo in the film 10, as many of your listeners might know. And the court actually credited American Airlines' argument that Bo Derek popularized the braided hairstyle. So this is not simply an issue for African-American women, ignoring the extent to which it would have a clear disparate impact on black women, specifically those who would wear their hair in braids. Black women who straighten their hair would not be a problem for American Airlines.
So, and by the way, then Bo Derek is an antecedent to the whole twerking argument that we're living with today. I think that's fascinating. Who appropriated whose hairstyle and dance moves? There you go.
Precisely.
So, but this business, Neetu, how does it show itself in day to day activity in terms of sort of policing? What? It's not just clothing. It's speech. It's posture. It's gait. Right? I mean, how deeply does this go in terms of how you respond in a different way or how you act in a different way in the workplace?
So you're asking exactly the right question. And this was some of the pushback we received initially when we started working on this, which was things like braids. And to go back to what Devin talked about, the Renee Rogers case, and this was our sense of what courts have felt about these kinds of cases, but it was also the sense we got from a lot of our very skeptical colleagues, which was that you're talking about truly trivial things. That, come on, you know, if your employer doesn't like you having your hair in braids, at some level, just suck it up and fit in. This is really not about race. They're actually giving you a job, so you should do this. And our point was, the whole day is full of these kinds of things. And not only that, in the Rene Rogers case, it was a case of the employer saying you have to do this and the employer employee saying I don't want to do it. Most of the time, we are trying to calculate, in part because we want to do well in the workplace, we're trying to calculate what do they think of me and what do they want. And then we're trying to do it before they even ask. And those kinds of micro behaviors in terms of your dress, how you teach your classes, how you behave in the lines at the airport, how you behave in the grocery store. I find myself, you know, you go to the grocery store, and I was talking to some of my students about this. You have those lines where you can have only 10 items, and you have the other lines where which are typically longer. I'm terribly scared of being told that I have too many items. And I'm always obsessively counting the number of items. And then I look over and I see there are all these people with what looks like 11, 12, 13 items who are very comfortable about going through them. So you add this up across the day, and especially in the workplace, and there's a lot of extra work that you end up doing in terms of policing your behavior.
No, but getting... Go ahead. Please finish.
No, I meant when you – our point was when you add it up, there's just extra work. And in the gender context, especially when you talk about things like makeup requirements or dress requirements, most women who work get what we're saying.
Well, and a lot of people do. And I want to get back to the pushback that you got from folks who said, hey, if you want to do that, that's your problem. And everybody needs to fit in. And this is not about race and it's not about gender. I mean, this whole idea that it's on you to figure out how you want to dress and that's your decision. It does strike me that we're very conscious of this in a lot of ways. And there's proof of, I mean, you know, Vice President Biden says, describes Barack Obama as clean and articulate. He's clearly looking for the right kind of black man. And then he has to apologize and backpedal for that. But I think it shows up even more clearly how conscious we are of these kinds of decisions in the world of comedy. Saturday Night Live took this on. You remember the skit they did, President Obama? They put him on the blackness scale. Now let's listen to how that went.
You're right about here, above Will Smith, but just below Bill Clinton. But this could change as the American people get to know you better. For example, you were raised by a single mother and your grandparents. Moving up. In Hawaii. Moving down. You have an African name, Barack. Moving up. But in high school, you went by Barry. Moving down. You married a black woman. Moving up. But in the past, you dated white women. Still moving up.
So we really can't say, Devin, that we're not conscious of this and that we're not aware of it, right?
Precisely. I think that clip is so smart, and I remember encountering it and showing it to Mitu, and we laughed hysterically, and then we simply said, absolutely brilliant. We must explicate this particular clip in our work. And the consequences of what we're talking about sometimes can involve life and death. To take us, for example, to the Trayvon Martin case, you might recall that there was an awful lot of discourse about whether what happened would have happened if Trayvon Martin were not wearing a hoodie. So it was clear in people's mind that his blackness might have been shaped by the fact that he was dressed in a way that signaled to some evidence of criminality. Now, obviously, we should contest that. We should find that deeply problematic. But it is just another example of the ways in which people read race, not just through the cues of phenotype, but through other performative dimensions as well.
And certainly the president himself has figured out a way to perform that in his speech that he gave after, well, first of all, initially after the episode itself and then after the verdict, identifying with African Americans, reminding people that that's who he was, but taking a kind of middle ground. So he acted as a sort of a bridge or an assimilationist in the sense that he was going to take us from one to the other. Would you say, me too?
Well, yes. Barack Obama is fascinating in so many different ways. But for us, he has had these moments where he has had to deal with the fact of race. And he's in this complicated situation where he has to appeal to members of multiple racial groups and have them all support him. And then these instances occur, as with Trayvon Martin, and he has both groups watching him so very carefully to see how black is he or how black isn't he. And I mean, every time he is in those situations, I mean, I just feel such incredible stress watching how he's going to negotiate it. And he has done it with Reverend Wright, for example, and with Trayvon Martin. He has done it brilliantly. But that doesn't mean that most of us can do it. I think he is really unusual in having not only been able to do this incredibly difficult dance between being too black and being white and not white enough, but he's done it successfully. And to me, that illustrates how difficult actually it is to do this on a daily basis for the rest of us.
And how subtle. And so, Devin, the difficulty of white males, for instance, to understand that there is all this effort going on since they don't have to do it, and it's never occurred to them that this could be a possibility for other folks. And so it's very hard, I would suspect, for white males in particular, let's pick them for a moment, to see that this is even true.
I think that's right. One way to understand it is to simply say, the ordinary norms around workplace governance take into account a certain identity default. And white male norms, it's not hyperbolic to say, generally define most workplace cultures. We're careful in the book to say that we think everyone works identity, which is to say everyone has some burden to fit in, including white heterosexual men, and we want to be very clear about that. We simply mean to point out at the same time that if you're vulnerable to being negative stereotype, those burdens are greater. And so it's a more generalizable phenomenon that has racial specificity as a result of the existence of negative racial stereotypes.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program. Devin Carbato, professor of law at UCLA. Meetu Gulati, professor of law at Duke. Thanks for being on the program.
Not at all.
Thank you, Frank.
They're co-authors of the new book, Acting White, Rethinking Race in Post-Racial America. Thanks for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.